Hello and welcome to episode 107 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Toedy, former skipper of the fast attack submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, many other postings. Bill, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great, Seth.
Outstanding. We're going to keep trucking along through the history of the Pacific War here. We're going to start today by discussing one of the more important events of the Pacific theater, or naval history for that matter, that being, of course, the very first carrier battle, Battle of Coral Sea. While many see Coral Sea as kind of a sideshow to the main event that will take place a month later in the waters around Midway Atoll, Coral Sea was actually a huge event, a really, really big deal, shall we say. This is where the doctrine for both the United States Navy and the Imperial Japanese Navy and their aircraft carriers would first be tested in carrier-to-carrier, carrier-versus-carrier battle. While the hit-and-run carrier raids of February and March tested American carrier doctrine to an extent, and the Pearl Harbor raid, as well as the Indian Ocean raids, tested Imperial Navy doctrine also to an extent, this is the very first time, as I said, that both navies tested each other's way of doing things and in the process found things that worked and things that, well, didn't work. So let's dig into it. Bill, set the stage for us. What are we looking at in early May, late February, late April, early May 1942?
Yeah, great, Seth. Hey, one of the reasons that you and I make such a great team is you know a lot of the personalities involved in each one of these campaigns. During your time at the World War II Museum, you got to meet and do oral histories with a lot of the the individuals who actually did the things we're going to be talking about.
Right.
In my case, you know, being a retired Navy captain, Pacific Fleet sailor, I steamed these oceans and seas in very exact places we talk about. So I looked at, you know, many of the islands that we're going to talk about, in most cases through the periscope of my submarine, but, you know, was able to see how tight the you know, seas are between Guadalcanal and Florida Island, or Tulagi, which we'll talk about later. So I understand the dynamic, the constraints of the actual physical space that we operated against the Imperial Japanese Navy. And in it's easy to forget that in early 1942, carrier warfare, particularly for the United States, was a relatively new thing. The first major carrier attack was actually the British against the Italians in the Battle of Taranto, which is the British carrier fleet attacking moored Italian Navy ships in 1940, earlier in the war before we joined. And in fact, it was that battle that the Japanese modeled the attack on Pearl Harbor after, because the Italian Navy was in very shallow ports. The British Navy had to figure out how to modify their torpedoes not to bottom in the harbor of Toronto. Now, they used a different tactic or technique than the Japanese ended up using for Pearl Harbor. They actually tied a string to the nose of the torpedo to keep the nose up as it was falling, whereas as opposed to the Japanese that put a wooden like crate on the fins. Nevertheless, you know, that was basically the first. The second major carrier battle was the attack on Pearl Harbor. And again, it was something that we didn't believe the Japanese were capable of doing. When we come into Coral Sea, we're going to say this over and over again today. It's the first time two fleets ever engaged each other without ever seeing each other. Now, obviously, the airplanes saw each other, but it was the first detached carrier versus carrier battle in history. And a lot of mistakes were made. Some things were done right, some things were done wrong. And we're going to talk about that. The Japanese at this point in the war were trying to block American reinforcement of Australia. And the way they planned on doing that was by taking Port Moresby to the west and Tulagi to the east. And then they were going to further reinforce those positions after Port Moresby and Tulagi were strengthened by taking Fiji, and New Caledonia, which we were going to be operating out of, and then in Central Pacific, they were going to block our advances to the west by taking Midway, And in the Northern Pacific, they were going to capture some American territory, actual American territory in the Aleutian Islands. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the North, Middle, South. And in the South, their first move was on the island of Tulagi. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese never understood how seriously we would take that. In particular, Admiral King would take, you know, the attack on Tulagi, and how aggressively we would move to defend it. So that's kind of the strategic picture that the United States Navy is facing as King directs Nimitz to direct Task Force 11 and 17 to advance on Coral Sea to block what we believed was an operation called Operation MO, which right. we believed was going to be an invasion, a sea-based invasion on Port Moresby. So with that, take it over there, Seth.
That's 100% right. I mean, that's a perfect setup. You know, Operation MO, as you said, was the planned invasion, Japanese invasion of Port Moresby. And Tulagi was a part of that. Tulagi is an island that we're going to hear a lot about here in the very near future, not just this episode, but you know, in a little island called Guadalcanal. There's a couple of issues with Tulagi, shall we say. But that's the first time you hear about it. You know, the Japanese wanted Tulagi and they took it to and it was basically, you know, it was an unopposed landing to set up a seaplane base to patrol those seas in screening for the Port Moresby invasion force.
Absolutely.
So the Japanese send as our good friend John Parshall says, the second team, if you will, a fleet carrier Shokaku Zuikaku out there to basically you know, shield the invasion force and then kind of also protect and defend against anything.
There were fleet carriers though, right? And they're part Correct. Of the strike force.
Right.
And there was a supporting force as well, right?
Right.
With the next level down of aircraft carriers.
Right, it's the Shoho she's an escort carrier for all intents and purposes. You know what we call an escort carrier. It's a very, very small aircraft carrier with a very small air group that's designed to protect the force going down that way.
Or the covering force.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So this is a good setup. You know, we're reading the traffic analysis. You know, we talk about this in the next. Or I'm sorry, in the previous episode about Station Hypo with Admiral Sam Cox, we talk about the traffic analysis. We weren't reading their mail per se, but we knew.
We got bits and pieces of the messages that we were able to decrypt. And in fact, Port MO, the Japanese weren't very clever with their abbreviation since Port Moresby starts with an MO.
It's the analysis allows Nimitz to be able to send the forces down there, and the forces that he sends down to the Coral Sea are the Yorktown and the Lexington CV2. Now Yorktown's already in that area of operations right now. She's in the South Pacific. She's in the Coral Sea area because what does she do? She launches a raid just before the Battle of Coral Sea on the island of Tulagi. Yeah, and this kind of, you know, raises the ire of the Japanese.
This is after the Japanese had done this unopposed landing of Tulagi.
Correct.
And we knew that they were going to try to operate it as a seaplane base, and we wanted to stop that.
Yeah, and this is all due to the intelligence that Captain Layton, Commander Layton, and the people at Station Hypo were able to decipher. Now Yorktown goes in there to Tulagi. She launches her air group out there, and they have some pretty good success. You know, they attack the targets in there. They hit several of the ships in the harbor, and
they claim to have destroyed way more than they actually did. Right?
Which is
kind of pervasive on both sides in this battle, actually. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the stuff that we're going to see here in this battle, specifically, more so than really. Even Midway, the sighting reports of both fleets. I mean, these guys couldn't have been more wrong. We'll get to that, but especially one particular site too, really. But it's unbelievable how inaccurate some of these descriptions were. But you know, the Yorktown attacks Tulagi. Her losses for her air group are very minimal. Really, it's a successful raid. You know, you could almost consider this. An extension of the hit and run carrier raids that we talk about in episode 105. Halsey. Yeah,
conducted.
Yeah. And Yorktown did some too, but not as Enterprise was everywhere. Right. You know, Yorktown was kind of scattershot, but this is an extension
the Admiral
of that.
In command of Task Force 17 with Yorktown was still Frank Jack Fletcher, right?
Correct.
He was in command during the Halsey carrier raids that we spoke about earlier.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So Jack Fletcher is kind of the Halsey to Yorktown. You know, right. Halsey was always aboard the Enterprise until he got mm-hmm. sick before Midway. And Fletcher's the same thing. He parks his flag on Yorktown and he just kind of stays there until Yorktown, of course, you know, meets her demise. But yeah, Fletcher's in charge. And then
in Task Force 11 on Lexington.
Yeah, that's under Admiral Aubrey Fitch. This is the same mm-hmm. guy who was aboard, who flew his flag aboard Saratoga as Saratoga was theoretically going to reinforce Wake Island in late December 41, mm-hmm. Who had to retreat into his cabin after hearing less than stellar conversations. Yeah. Right. And Fitch does a pretty good job. You know, we'll get into some of the decisions that he makes here in just a bit, but he does, it's not a guy you hear a lot about, but mm-hmm. he fared pretty well in this, his one really major action of the war.
With the limitation of the way we operated our carrier strike groups, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, you said it when you started off talking about this, is that this is a learning experience. And, mm-hmm. you know, you don't necessarily want to be learning things as you're being thrown into the fire, per se. You know, you'd like to have your operations ironed to a T before you ever get into the fight. But this is the nature of carrier warfare for the United States in 1942. Japanese are complete opposites of that. They know what they're doing, but we don't. You know?
Well, speaking about learning, I'm reminded that the Naval History and Heritage Command has kind of put on YouTube a bunch of videos from the era, and some of them were lessons learned videos. And one collection in particular I recall is a collection on the Battle of Coral Sea. Mm-hmm. It was actually conducted by the Naval War College in 1950. And the only reason I bring it up is because, number one, it's fairly contemporaneous to done only, you know, a handful of years, I guess 8 years after the battle itself took place, with nearly everybody who was present during the battle right. still alive and available to generate what their lessons learned. But the second, maybe even more memorable thing of these videos is that they're so racist, you can't help but get cringe when you watch them, because okay. you have the narrator of the videos kind of imitating his version of what the Japanese were thinking using a very stereotyped Japanese accent, right? Yeah. In English. Yeah. And it's cringeworthy. Yeah. But it does kind of contain exactly the right lessons that we were still trying to learn as late as 1950 mm-hmm. from this battle that took place in May of 1942.
Yeah. And that's, you know, people, historians, you know, often brush this event over because they, you know, you talk about Pearl Harbor, a lot of people skip the carrier raids, which we cover. And then everybody wants to talk about the Doolittle Raid. Well, Doolittle Raid, yeah, you know, and then they jump over Coral Sea because they want to get to the meat. They want to get to Midway. But Coral Sea was a big deal. And it, you know, and we're going to get into this in a second, yeah. but it was a big deal. And it's, mm-hmm. it's something that taught lessons all throughout the war, really, for everybody, both the United States and the Japanese. And we're going to get to that. So,
well, but before you leave the Doolittle Raid, mm-hmm. you're right. It was kind of a widely regarded as a pinprick.
Right.
It did almost no damage, but it was a moral victory for the United States. If it did have one impact on the Japanese psyche, two things. Number one, they knew that they weren't invulnerable. Right. Number two, there is some record that they accelerated the Southern offensive into Port Moresby. And maybe accelerated it in such a way that they weren't quite as prepared as they might have been otherwise had we not conducted the Doolittle Raid, which played to our advantage,
right?
In Coral Sea.
And this is something too that we're going to see in a lot of Japanese operations from here on out, is that, you know, the preparations and some of these events, like specifically, you know, Coral Sea to a point, but Midway especially, mm-hmm. the preparations and the planning was extensive, but it was the way that the Japanese parceled out their forces that, you know, is very
overly complex operational plans.
Yeah. Big time. Ridiculous, you know, to a point. And it's very anti-Mahanian, if you will, you know, splitting their forces all over the damn place. As opposed
one advantage they did have over ours is they all their forces were under the 4th Fleet, the 4th Carrier Fleet. And whereas we had our AOR split between Nimitz as Sink Pack and MacArthur as Pack Southwest. Right. And because of that, all of the land-based surveillance aircraft flew, operated under MacArthur's command, and nobody had overall tactical control of all the forces that were operating in the theater during the Battle of Korsi on the American side. Whereas on the Japanese side, they had unity of command.
Right. Very true. Very true. And we're going to see a real quick, we're going to get into it. You're going to see something that happens here with the disunity of command on the American side here. On May 6th, Fletcher and Fitch, Lexington and Yorktown unite. They're one group.
And Seth, there was a group of Australians here as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Heck yeah. Yeah. We're going to Admiral Crace.
Crace,
Crace, C-R-A-C-E, Crace.
And they're cruisers and destroyers, as I recall.
Cruisers and destroyers are part of the screening force for Admiral Fletcher. So on the 6th of May, Fletcher is aware, they're in the Coral Sea now, he's aware that Japanese CVs, the Japanese carriers, are in the area, and that the Japanese invasion fleet is not far behind, that they're making their way to Port Moresby. This thing that Commander Layton and Station Hypo and
Joe Rochefort
predicted, that they predicted, well, it's happening. So yet again, this is a harbinger of things to come when it comes to Station Midway. Hypo and everybody else. Yeah, these guys know what the hell they're doing. And Fletcher is aware that the Japanese are coming, and he makes, you know, Fletcher can be praised in some things and criticized in others. And I personally, professionally, am not a huge fan of the man. I think he made some significant errors in his judgment, not just here, but off of Guadalcanal too.
Well, neither was Admiral King, right? He kept looking for reasons to fire him.
Yeah. Well, this potentially could have been one. Aware of the fact that the Japanese are in the area with aircraft carriers, Admiral Fletcher detaches Admiral Crace, the gentleman we just talked about, the Australian Admiral's
cruiser group,
to go block the Jomard Passage. He knows the invasion fleet is coming. He sends his cruisers out there to potentially engage in a gunfight with the Japanese and stop this invasion force from coming.
But he knows the Japanese have carriers, and he sends these cruisers out by themselves to engage in a gunfight against a carrier force.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is where, you know, you can get very, very critical of Admiral Fletcher. I mean, the results of unprotected surface vessels versus aircraft carrier air groups, specifically Japanese carrier groups, had already been shown. You know, Repulse, Prince of Wales, are sunk because they're unescorted. They don't have air cover. They're sunk by Japanese, well, not carrier groups, but they're sunk by Japanese aircraft. Mm-hmm. So, you know, air power over sea power is a known thing. You know, Fletcher had to have known this, yet he still risks these cruisers that, had Crace not been as skillful as he was in his maneuvering, he could have lost them all, or at least a very great many of them, because lo and behold, no surprise here, the Japanese find them. Yeah. And the Japanese launched several attacks against Crace's cruisers. Mm-hmm. And again, because of Crace's skillful maneuvering, the maneuvering of the skippers of these cruisers and destroyers, none of them are hit by the grace of God. But it's a critical error committed by Fletcher here, in that he just sends these guys off without any air cover whatsoever.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah.
I hate to do this, Seth, but, you know, if we can think, we're going to jump forward to Midway just for a second. Uh-huh. The guy who's in overall command is Fletcher. Mm-hmm. And the guy who commands the other carrier strike force at Midway is some dude named Spruance. Now, Spruance, at this point, is the cruiser commander for the Enterprise strike group under Halsey, when they just came back from the carrier raids that we talked about last episode. When Fletcher makes the error in Coral Sea of sending Crace's cruisers forward against an an aircraft carrier force, that's an error that Spruance absolutely avoids making
right
in Midway. And it's just really important to remember that, because Fletcher is, in theory at least, Spruance's boss at Midway. Mm-hmm. And so he may have been schooled on this Fletcher error that happened in Coral Sea before, and that may be part of the reason why he avoids making the same error Midway. But we'll talk about that later in our Midway episodes.
Episodes, plural. You know, the Japanese, this goes on to the scouting and the reports of, you know, we talked about, you know, how much of an error these pilots are making. And, you know, mm-hmm. a lot can be thrown on that, mainly, you know, as far as the Japanese are concerned. They launched 3 attacks against Crace's cruiser group and don't hit them. Crace's cruiser group is also attacked by, wait for it,
land-based air.
Yes, but from General Douglas MacArthur's command.
Oh, that's B-17s. Right. That's right. Yeah. MacArthur's force attacks Crace's cruiser force.
Yep.
Happily, they sucked.
Yeah.
And they didn't hit them, right?
They couldn't hit the broadside of a barn from inside the barn. But yet again, this is the, you know, disunity of command we were talking about here. MacArthur, well, I mean, granted, MacArthur didn't give the order to send the B-17s out there, but they were part of his command. And, you know, the Japanese didn't hit anything. Didn't hurt a single ship, yet they make a report out that says they sunk a battleship, which there weren't any.
There weren't any.
Damaged a second battleship, which again, there weren't any. And a cruiser. And the Japanese sent no further attacks into this area because they thought that they had destroyed this group of women. And in actuality, they never hit a damn thing. Mm-hmm. And there certainly weren't any battleships there to hit. So this is also kind of touching on what we're going to get into here in a second, is about the poor scouting abilities of both navies. And that can be, you know, attributed to the fact that, you know, this is the first carrier battle. And even though the Japanese pilots on Shokaku and Zuikaku have seen combat, they haven't been to sea and been, you know, tangled up with an enemy fleet as they're about to be here in the next
right.
2 days. So, you know, we could debate the decision by Fletcher to send these cruisers out there, you know, without air cover for the rest of the episode, and we're not going to, but it's a horrible decision. It's not the last one that he makes, you know, in his career here in the Pacific War. But let's move on to the next day. So the next day, this is May 7th, 1942. This will be the first day of the Battle of Coral Sea as we know it. Early on the morning of the 7th, Japanese launched searches to find the American carriers. We do the same thing to find their carriers that we know are there. The Japanese scout planes from Shikoku find U.S. ships and radio Admiral Tagaki, that's the fella in charge here on mm-hmm. the Japanese side, of 1 American aircraft carrier, 1 cruiser, and 3 destroyers. Now, obviously, this guy is seeing part of the American fleet, but at least he identifies the ships correctly, or so he thinks. What the Japanese actually sight is the detached 2 ships.
Yosho and Euler.
An oiler and a destroyer. So he thinks he sees an aircraft carrier, a cruiser, and 3 destroyers. So that would be 5 ships, when in actuality mm-hmm. there's only 2, and one of them's an oiler, and there's no carriers anywhere near there. Yeah. So it's again, you got to wonder, how the hell did he screw this up that damn bad?
Well, scout planes are flying at very high altitudes, so they're really only seeing kind of the shape, the outline of the ship, and an oiler is a big ship. Okay, I'm just going to shock you to hear this, Seth. I've misidentified ships looking through the periscope before.
Yeah.
But I haven't counted 5 when there are only 2.
That's my point.
I haven't made that mistake before. And so, yeah, sometimes you see something and you want it to be something so bad, you can kind of see it in there. And but
you can count.
Yeah, you can count. And yeah. The only explanation for this is he wanted to be the hero that discovered the Americans. Never believed that the oiler would be detached from the carrier group, or the one ship that he saw that we have split the carrier group up. And so he's reporting it, and he wants to be that hero. He believes they're really there and wants to be the guy that reported them and take credit for that.
Well, he sends this report back, and the Japanese Admiral Tagaki, he's like, okay, yep, this is it. This is what we're here to do. Yep. And they launch a deck load, you know, and that's what it's called, a deck load strike. They launch everything they have. It's a hell of a lot of aircraft. They're going out there. They're sending a strike from the carriers out there. So the Japanese pilot and overall aerial command, they reach the supposed point of interception, only to look down and find an oiler and a destroyer. And he's like, nah, this can't be what we're out here for. Yeah, so he continues on. We must have missed it. Right. So he continues on. They fly over the Neosho and the Sims. And then they realize that, no, this is actually what they sent us out here to do. And we got to do something with this. We're not going to return empty handed. So he is given permission to strike these two vessels. And I mean, it's no surprise here, you know, the USS Sims is sunk very quickly. You know, they give a good account of themselves, but they're, you know, it's a destroyer and an oiler against an entire Japanese airstrike. So the destroyer is sunk very quickly. Neosho is basically left in a derelict state. You know, she's abandoned, but she's floating. She's still afloat. She remains afloat for a couple of days until she's scuttled by an American destroyer who finds her and what's left of her crew adrift in the Pacific Ocean. But this is the second, theoretically, of many mistakes made by both sides here. You know, Fletcher sends out the cruisers. The Japanese think they see a carrier and they attack an oiler. And it just goes back and forth and back and forth for the rest of the event here until the following day. At about 8:15 that morning, same morning, May 7th, Yorktown SBD, piloted by a guy named John Nielsen, finds the Japanese screening force under Admiral Goto, which includes the light carrier Shoho. An error in Nielsen's coding says that he found two CVs instead of just one. So this gets back to the erroneous report gets back to Admiral Fletcher, who says, oh man, I've got two carriers out here that Nielsen's found. We're going to launch the kitchen sink. So he does the exact same thing that the Japanese Admiral did. He launches a deck load from Yorktown and Lexington.
But happily, it's more than just an oiler and a destroyer that he finds.
It is. It is. But it's not the meat on the table.
It's not the fleet carriers.
Right. So he sends everything he's got out there, which is, as I said, a full deck load from Lexington, a full deck load from Yorktown. And they're going out there to find what they think are two Japanese fleet carriers, Shokaku and Zuikaku. And it actually is the light carrier Shoho that they stumble upon. And the beating that the American air groups give Shoho is, it's merciless. The first group that finds Shoho or that comes in contact with her is Lexington Air Group under the command of Bill Ault, is the guy's name. They arrive over Shoho first. Lexington or Yorktown's group is not far behind. They're probably about 30, 35 minutes behind Lexington's air group-ish, give or take a few minutes. And this is really the only successful coordinated American carrier air attack of 1942.
And it's counterintuitive because it was the first one. And usually you start out bad and learn over time and get better.
Exactly.
But this one is the only one we do right in the entire year.
Damn near, because I mean, if you get into Midway, you know, there's a lot of luck involved in what happens in those famous 4 minutes on June 4th. But this is a really well coordinated attack, you know, and it's
a single carrier attack, but it's still well coordinated,
very much so. And and that the fighters are covering everybody, the SBDs are up high, the TBDs are down low, the TBD devastators, now, you know, they split into a hammer and anvil attack on Shoho. And you know, and explaining that, Bill, can you
tell us? We'll see the ships turn as ships driving forward. When they see a torpedo, they're going to maneuver in such a way to improve the probability that the torpedo will miss. Well, if you attack from both bow directions at the same time and drop torpedoes in from both bow directions, there's no place to go. Right. You turn port to avoid the ones on starboard, turn port to avoid the ones on port, turn hard port. Doesn't matter what you do, one of those torpedoes is going to get you. That's a hammer and anvil attack.
Exactly. And that's exactly what happens here. It's really the only successful attack made by the TBD Devastator in World War II against an enemy ship.
It was an obsolete airplane, even then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was way old. Mm-hmm. But this is the only time in the Pacific War where the TBDs attack a worthy target and hit it and help sink it. I mean, Shoho takes at least two bomb hits from the SBDs that are attacking. Mm-hmm. This is VS2 and VB2, bombing 2 and scouting 2 from Lexington. And you know, their accuracy is not frankly what it should be, but the TBDs lay into it. There are at least 5 confirmed torpedo hits against Shoho or on Shoho by the TBDs of VT2.
This is kind of the opposite of what's going to happen in Midway again.
Complete opposite. Complete opposite. And part of this is because while Shoho does have some they have some combat air patrol up in the air, it's very, very minimal. Mm-hmm. And it's a coordinated American attack. So the F-4Fs that are there and the SBDs to a point also can help fend off some of these zeros. So the TBDs kind of come in there unmolested. They're mm-hmm. facing any aircraft fire, but they're kind of coming in unmolested and they're able to do what they can do. Yeah. And they lay a pretty good hit in there. They really mm-hmm. do. They put a lick on Shoho, so much so that by the time Lexington Air Group is pulling away, she's pretty much done for already.
And then the Yorktown Air Group shows up.
Exactly. And then Yorktown, you know, she just adds more fuel to the fire, just, you know, more insult to injury, literally, if you will. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And in Yorktown Air Group, it's estimated that they laid 11 bombs on Shoho and 2 more torpedoes. Yeah. You know, the 11 bombs could be attributed there. And I mean, that's just guesstimates because they stopped counting the hits on Shoho, much like you would see at Midway on Kaga. But she's slowing down. She's going down. She's already going down by the head. She's going down by the bow. I knew a couple of guys that were in Torpedo Squadron 2, flew in the same airplane. Walt that's Nelson,
Lexington, right?
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Walt Nelson and Ted Wiebe were bombardier and radium and gunner on the TBDs as they were attacking Shoho. I remember Walt, who was the radium and gunner, he was in the backseat. He was watching Shoho as she got hit by but what they think is their torpedo. There's an image of Shoho being attacked and you can see Lexington TBDs in the air and you can see a huge plume of water. Yeah, it's very evident she got hit by a torpedo there. And mm-hmm. the thought is, and the stacking of the flights is that, or the stacking of the squadron rather, is that it was Nelson and Weeby's aircraft that did, in fact, do that damage to Shoho. Mm-hmm. But I remember Walt saying that as they were pulling away, and you got to remember a TBD pulling away is like a snail crawling uphill, you know, it's not really getting out there fast.
Yeah.
He was watching her go down by the bow, you know, and by the time Yorktown's group got there, they just beat the living brains out of what was left of that thing. And by the time they do pull out, she's barely afloat by 11:35 that morning.
Well, in fact, the Yorktown's air group starts attacking the other ships too, right? Because they realize,
correct,
you know, geez, we've pounded this one into submission. Yeah. What else is of value here?
Yeah. But even so, mm-hmm. two full American air groups and 2 coordinated attacks hit, you know, this carrier. And I mean, it's kind of like it's, you know, the sharks of blood in the water, you know, it's the first time these guys are getting a crack at a Japanese aircraft carrier and they just lay waste. Mm.
So Fletcher was kind of upset that there weren't 2 aircraft carriers, that he wasted both air wings on a single escort carrier.
Exactly. And that's the thing too, is, you know, he takes Nielsen at his word, which he's supposed to, that's what the guy's out there for.
Absolutely.
And he launches, you know, 2 full strikes at what is of course later determined to be an escort carrier or light carrier, whatever you want, mm-hmm. however you want to call it. And when Nielsen gets back to Yorktown, he goes up to Admiral Fletcher and says, I'm sorry, I know I coded that, or, you know, his radio and gunner actually coded it wrong. Regardless of this, the message that I sent is wrong. It's not 2 carriers, it's actually 1. And Fletcher loses his mind on Nielsen, and frankly, rightfully so.
Yeah.
Because the young aviator and his radio and gunner are the ones that screw this up. And Fletcher knows that he just sent the kitchen sink. Mm-hmm. At a, you know, a second line ship, if you will.
Yep.
And he is now exposed to anything that might come from the big boys.
Both of his carriers are exposed now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So he loses his mind on Nielsen, and he has every right to do so.
Yeah.
But it does meet with success, because as the air groups are pulling away from Shoho, as I said, as we said, you know, they pummel this thing into submission and you know, pulverize it. One of the more famous radio transmissions of the Pacific War is made by a guy named Bob Dixon, mm-hmm. from Bombing Squadron 2 on USS Lexington. He radios back. It was a prearranged signal. So, you know, for years it was thought to be off the cuff, but it wasn't. It was a prearranged signal. He radios back to Admiral Fitch aboard Lexington, and he says, quote, scratch one
flat top. Right.
That's it. Yeah. Scratch one flat top. And it's the first time we sink, you know, a Japanese, like a significant man of war. No, it's not, you know, Shokaku Zorikaku, but it's still an aircraft carrier, and we beat its brains out, you know. Yep. We absolutely pummel it. Now, what do the Japanese do, you know, at this point? Not a whole hell of a lot right now. On the 7th of May, they don't do much. They're trying to, you know, remember, they send out everything they have against the Neosho and the Sims, God bless them. Mm-hmm. But they don't really do anything else. They do theoretically find the location of the American aircraft carriers later that day as the sun is setting. They do make a launch. The Japanese do send out a strike against the American aircraft carriers, but they can't find them because it's getting dark. Mm-hmm. Some of their aviators, it's kind of a odd story, but some of their aviators, as they were coming in to land on what they thought were their home carriers, they actually tried to land on Yorktown. The fleets were that yep. close. Uh-huh.
Yeah, they 60 were miles, close. I think, or something yeah. like that at this point. Something
like 60 nautical yeah. miles, I think so, yeah. yeah. I mean, they were that close that, they, you know, neither of them really realized how close they were. Mm. And the Japanese, as it's getting dark, you know, they're coming in with these odd colored landing lights on their airplanes, and they're making odd approaches, as you know, not the typical approach that U.S. naval aircraft do. And at the last second, as these guys are literally hooked down, getting ready to land on the USS Yorktown, it is realized by American forces that those ain't those SBDs. Aren't Americans, yeah. And the fleet lights it up, and they throw up everything. Everything just, you know, it's like, as they say, 4th of July. There's actually
some film footage of this, because, and you could tell because the trajectory of the anti-aircraft fire is horizontal.
Yeah, it's very low.
They're shooting at aircraft that are very low, basically in the landing pattern. Yeah. And so, yeah.
They light it up. The Japanese realize too, oh, crap, this isn't Shokaku. And they, you know, pour the coal to him and get out of there. It's not known if they shot any down. It is known that several of the Japanese aircraft that were sent out on that strike did not make it back to their carriers. Now, whether they got lost or they got shot down, nobody knows. But it was a rather odd instance in the Pacific War. And it just kind of adds to the confusion and the chaos that actually is the Battle of Coral Sea. So the 7th of May ends rather well for the United States. You know, we, granted, we lose an oiler and a destroyer, but we sink a carrier, and we don't suffer any damage to our aircraft carriers, Lexington and Yorktown, in return. So day one of the first carrier battle of the war is, you know, one up for the U.S.
Right.
But day two does not necessarily turn out like that.
No.
So as opposed to other carrier battles that we're going to talk about in 42, you know, Coral Sea is a 2-day event, well, 3-day really, technically, if you want to be, you know, completely technical. The next day, May 8th, both forces, American and Japanese, you know, they launch their scouts early in the morning, as they do always, and they both find each other almost simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Similar to what happened the day before, you know, the intelligence, however, on this day, is that, and by intelligence, I'm talking about the sighting reports, are actually fairly accurate. I said everything before was erroneous, except for the last day. This is the last day. You know, the Americans sight the Japanese fleet carrier Shokaku Zuikaku. The Japanese sight the American fleet carriers Lexington and Yorktown. Mm-hmm. And as a result, both admirals launch again, just about everything they got.
The Americans beat the Japanese into the air by maybe 15 minutes, something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, these guys are close to one another now. Not within visual range, but they're close. And the opposing air groups actually pass one another in the air.
Mm-hmm.
The Lexington and Yorktown air groups pass Shokaku and Zuikaku air groups as they're heading to each other.
Do they sight each other?
Oh yeah, they see each other.
Wow.
And they just keep on. There is some dogfighting and some mixing up in the air, but nothing very significant yet. Mm-hmm. This is also not the first time that this happens in the Pacific War. We'll see it again at Santa Cruz in October.
Right.
But the well-coordinated attacks of May 7th, the previous day, give way to the absolute mess. Yeah, yeah, that is May 8th. So everything that went right for the Americans on the 7th goes completely opposite on May 8th.
The weather has plays a role in that too as well, right?
It certainly does. Yeah. You know, as you know, the carriers are spotted and they're coming in, the American air groups are coming in, and the only carrier that they see is Shokaku. Now they see Zuikaku, she kind of dips in and out of a rain squall, but as the Yorktown air group is coming in, they can't find Zuikaku to attack her. So they throw everything at Shokaku.
Right.
And they put a pretty good lick on Shokaku. I think she's hit, she's hit several times. She's hit several times, at least twice, by 2 1,000-pound bombs dropped by Yorktown's air group under the command of a guy named Bill Birch. Mm-hmm. Bill Birch is leading this strike. Shokaku's moving radically, you know, I mean, she's twisting and turning like a, kind of like a snake on a sidewalk, and yet they're still able to hit her. And these two bombs, they disable the flight deck in such a way that Shokaku is burning pretty severely. Mm-hmm. She's on fire. Her flight deck is ruined for the present time. And it's very clear that she's going to be of no more use in this event. Her captain requests permission to retire and is given that permission. Now, before we get to her tailing off here, she's attacked by TBDs from Yorktown and Lexington, and she's not hit one time. The success of May 7th does not translate to May 8th.
We're going to have torpedo problems for the first year and a half of this war, as it turns out.
Right.
And it's not clear whether the TB is just missed or whether there were some impacts and the torpedoes didn't detonate.
Well, and that's the thing, is that there were reports on both sides, well, specifically Americans, that the torpedoes did strike Shokaku but failed to explode. Now, most of the torpedoes that were launched against the carrier just flat out miss.
Mm-hmm.
And the reasons for that are skillful maneuvering by the Japanese captain and just frankly poor marksmanship on the point of the TBD pilots on Yorktown and Lexington's air group. But all the success that the TBDs had the day before does not translate to the 8th. They do no underwater ship killing damage to Shokaku.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the DC party on Shokaku winds up putting out the fires, but as I said, she's wrecked in such a state that she can't participate in the event anymore. And she retires on full speed, flank speed, and gets the hell out of the area. Zuikaku, you know, as we mentioned before, is coming in under a rain squall, and she is attacked when she does pop out, but it's no damage is done to her. Lexington's air group, you know, as coordinated as they were the day before, again, it's like, you got to wonder what the hell happened, because half the air group for Lexington couldn't even find a target. So, you know, it's unclear to me what exactly happened in the air there, but it's very clear. I mean, literally half the air group found the target. The other half didn't find anything at all. So something happened there. And it sucks, because the damage that they could have done is, you know, something
significant.
Yeah. 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 It really is. But the Japanese, on the other hand, they know where Yorktown and Lexington are. And the haphazard way that we attack their carriers, you know, at almost the same time, really, is an opposite reflection of what the Japanese do to our carriers, Lexington and Yorktown.
And you jump to what happened, it's even more remarkable because we had radar and they did not, right?
Right.
So we were able to see their incoming aircraft at a range of maybe 60 miles or something right. like that. And so we should have been able to direct our combat air patrol to intercept. And we didn't do that. Why not?
Well, you nailed it when you said about 60 miles. It was actually 68 okay. nautical miles is where you were damn close, where the radar picked them up. Mm-hmm. And the radar I'm talking about is Lexington CXAM radar. Mm-hmm. Picks up the Japanese coming in. So we know they're coming. Not only do we see them literally pass one another, but the radar picks them up. And the fighter director on Lexington vectors out his combat air patrol to intercept the incoming Japanese strike, but fails to place them at the proper altitude. Mm-hmm. The F-4Fs weren't they were either too low or too high. They were not where they needed to be to intercept the Japanese coming in. So what little we had the aircraft in the air to do a fairly significant amount of damage. It's just they were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
So it wasn't because the Wildcat was a really crappy
no.
fighter.
No.
It was because we directed them improperly, which they're not as good as a Zero to begin with. And then that's one hand tied behind your back. And then when you send them to the wrong altitude, that's two hands tied behind
your back. Yeah, you can't do anything if you can't find them.
Yeah.
You can't hit them if you can't see them. Mm. And let me be clear, they do see them. You know, mm-hmm. Lexington's combat and the American fleet, because Yorktown had some people up there too. They do see the Japanese, but they can't get to them. By the time they get to them, come on, the attack is over. They're gone. They wind up shooting down a few on their way out, but that doesn't do anything for what happens.
Now, this point of the war, just to step back to the tactics for a moment, you need fighters to cover what we've been calling the combat air patrol, which right. is to protect the aircraft carriers. But you also need fighters to accompany the attack right. force.
Right.
And so that requires a lot of fighters. Yes. And, you know, because basically 2X, we didn't populate our aircraft carriers with a sufficient number of fighters during the Battle of Coryssee. We're going to change that later. We're going to learn from this battle and add more fighters to the carrier air wing complement. But for this battle, how do we make up for the fact that we didn't have enough fighters to cover both combat air patrol and cover the attacking airplanes that are going after the Japanese carriers?
So this is one of the stranger aspects of this battle is that, just as you said, we didn't have enough fighters. What Yorktown does is they put up SBDs, Dauntless Dive Bombers, as anti-torpedo plane patrols. The SBDs, Scout
not,
Bomber
not
Douglas,
much better. Okay.
it was nicknamed by the pilots the slow but deadly. You know, I mean, this is one of the most successful aircraft of World War II. However, it was not designed to be a fighter plane. It was not designed to fly combat air patrol, yet it continues to do so. You see it a couple times later on in the Pacific War, but this is really the first time that it's done, because it's strange, because we don't have enough fighters, as you said. We don't have the fighters to do both
combat air patrol
jobs at once. You know? Exactly. Yeah. And you got to do what you got to do. So they send out these dauntless would be. They send them out to be anti-torpedo plane patrol. Combat air patrol, however you want to talk about it. One of the pilots is a guy named Stanley Vedisa. They nicknamed him the Swede Vedisa. He was a personal friend of mine that I knew for many, many years. I knew him very, very well. Mm-hmm. Now, Swede, again, he's a dive bomber pilot in VS Scouting Squadron 5 on USS Yorktown. He is out there. And he knew, he's like, this is not what this airplane is designed to do.
No,
yeah, he's a combat.
Good.
No, he's a combat vet. So he's flown the Leyan Salamaua raid, which is something we did not talk about. Mm. He's flown the strike on Tulagi. He flew the strike on Shoho the day before. And theoretically, he's credited with being one of the ones who hit her. And now he's out there flying as dauntless as anti-torpedo plane patrol. Well, he is flying in formation in a company with two other SBDs. It's a gaggle of three. And he notices something out of the corner of his eye, a glint, in the sky, a glint of metal, flash. And he's like, we don't have anybody back there. He immediately breaks the formation because he knows what's coming. It's a Japanese air attack. The Japanese pass through its aircraft from Zuikaku. They pass through the formation of SPDs and shoot down both of Swede's wingmen. Mm-hmm. And Swede maneuvers himself out of the way. And in turn, Swede finds himself in a dogfight in his SPD with three Japanese aircraft. And it becomes an event. You know, most dogfights, if you look at any fighter, if you talk to any fighter pilot from World War II of any nation, most dogfights are seconds long, mm-hmm. you know, maybe a minute or two, maybe. This goes on from, you know, Swede estimated after, you know, after the years after the event, he estimated anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes that these guys are trying to shoot him down, their fighter planes scissoring.
Well, it probably takes him that long just to turn. But
he was a hell of a pilot. Swede Vetteza was a hell of a pilot. And he is in this dogfight with these three enemy aircraft. And, you know, a Dauntless has two crew members. It's got a pilot and it's got a radioman gunner behind him. Mm-hmm. And the whole purpose, well, two purpose for the radioman gunner is to be the radioman, to radio and to send messages and receive messages, you know. And then also he's got an A&M 30 caliber air-cooled machine gun in the back of that SPD to protect the tail mm-hmm. of that airplane. Swede is maneuvering his Dauntless so violently that the rear seat gunner can't actually pick the weapon up to fire at the Japanese behind it.
He can't protect the six.
So, no, because yeah. Swede is throwing this thing around so harshly and doing, you know, what he's frankly born to do, which is to be a fighter pilot. You'll hear about Swede again in another episode or two. He skillfully maneuvers his SPD out of the way to where he does not get shot down by these three Japanese aircraft.
He shoots
them down.
All three.
In his SPD Dauntless dive bomber. This is the birth. Yeah, no kidding. This is the birth. And he's not the only guy to do it at Coral Sea. There was another fellow, another SPD pilot named John Lepla, who did the same thing. I don't think he shot down two, but regardless, he shoots down enemy aircraft with a Dauntless dive bomber. And Swede is a born fighter pilot. You know, there's a myth about how, oh, after they heard about this, you know, he was recruited to fighting 10 with Jimmy Flatley. That's not true at all. Swede actually had already been given orders to report to fighting Squadron 10 2 days before the battle occurred. He was mm-hmm. supposed to go back to Pearl Harbor aboard the oiler Neosho. Mm-hmm. And he begged the air group commander aboard Yorktown to say, hey, look, because I know this fleet action's coming.
Well, you're going to need me. Neosho didn't make it back anyway, so it was a good move both ways.
Exactly. Yeah. Swede participates in the raid on Shoho, gets a hit. Next day, he shoots down three Japanese aircraft in his SPD.
Yeah. Incredible.
And he goes on to become one of America's most decorated fighter pilots of the Pacific Theater.
Wow.
And we'll talk about him in future episodes. But it's one of the stranger aspects of Coral Sea, but it's freaking
regardless
cool.
of despite Swede's valiant attempts, the American carriers are still struck, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, Yorktown's hit by a couple of bombs. They don't kill Yorktown, obviously, but they do some significant damage to her. And, you know, she winds up going back to the yard. And of course, you know,
one of the things that happens to her is, you know, her elevators are put out of commission, at least that's what they thought. And she loses her superheaters for boilers, which means she can't do flight speed anymore, which affects her ability to evade all these incoming attacks.
So, that she's going to see in a month.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But the other aircraft, and to be clear, Yorktown does survive this battle, but the other aircraft carrier in her company, the USS Lexington, does not. Lexington is, and let's, you know, set the stage here. Lexington's an old carrier. She's the second.
Number two.
Yeah. CV2. Exactly. She's a converted battle cruiser. You know, I say that she was turned into an aircraft carrier on a battle cruiser hull. Mm-hmm. She's very fast. I mean, she could knock down, you know, just south or right at 30 knots. She could move. She could get out there to clip, but she was huge. And she turned, like I like to say, she turned like a whale. I mean, she just, you know, slow at the helm, sluggish at the helm. And it was very, very difficult for her to evade the torpedoes that are coming in. And she gets hit by two bombs, neither of which really do much. I mean, they unfortunately kill, Marine gunners on the portside gun gallery, but they don't knock the ship out of action. The fires that are started by the bombs are quickly put out. It's the torpedoes that she takes, and she only takes two, but one of the torpedoes that she does take ruptures her avgas tanks. And this is what happens when you take a battle cruiser and convert it into an aircraft carrier. You know, the fuel stowage is not what it's supposed to be. You know,
and the fuel lines aren't run the way they should have been run.
No, they're not. And it's just, you know, I mean, this is a carrier that was built and commissioned in 1927. So she's an old lady. And, it's just, she wasn't designed for modern carrier warfare. And this is her, seals her fate. You know, it really
and does. But there were actually procedures that if they put into effect might've mitigated the damage, but we weren't smart enough to know to do that during the Battle of Coral Sea. We actually changed the procedures on how to treat the fuel lines before Midway,
right,
which has a big impact on the outcome of Midway.
Oh, for sure. But we didn't know.
Right.
We didn't know, you know. And the thing is, the frustrating thing is that Lexington takes her two torpedo hits. She takes her bomb hits like a champ. Like, she's not going down, man. I mean, she does go down by the bow. She is going down by the head a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you look at images of her after she's hit, it's very evident in the picture she is down by the bow. Mm-hmm. But she's still conducting flight ops. She's still landing and launching aircraft after
this. 20 knots, something like that. Yeah, absolutely.
She's not dying. Mm-hmm. It's the internal leaking of the avgas fumes, not the fuel itself, mind you, the fumes from the ruptured tanks that seals her fate.
The crew was adhering to the old Navy dictum, don't give up the ship. They were not. They were fighting.
No. Oh.
But that the avgas fumes, there were DC motors. And even when I was chief engineer on a nuclear submarine, we had some DC motors. And DC motors use these carbon brushes to transit the electricity from the rotor to the stator. And those carbon brushes spark, even as late as the 1980s, 1990s. We still had these carbon brushes that occasionally would spark. Mm-hmm. And you take the aviation gasoline that's leaking from all these broken pipes from the torpedo attack, and then you sparking DC motors, and that's a recipe for an explosion. And that's what happened.
That's exactly what took her out. Yeah. You could say the Japanese sunk her because it was a torpedo hit that caused the avgas tanks to rupture. Mm-hmm. It caused the fumes to spread and kaboom. But
The damage control teams were controlling the flooding.
Yeah.
It was looking like they were still doing flight ops until the explosion, which at that point could not be avoided.
No, there's nothing that they could do. It was unexpected. You know, as you said, they had righted. She did have a little bit of a list. She was down by the head, but they counter flooded and they righted the ship. And as you said, she's conducting flight ops. People aboard her inside of Lex stated after the fact they could smell fuel. Now, it's an aircraft carrier, so you can smell fuel pretty much all the time. But they're smelling fuel where they're not supposed to be smelling fuel, like down in the bowels of the ship. Mm. And exactly what you said just happened, or exactly what you just said happened, in that, you know, one of the DC, it's thought, and it's probably correct, one of those DC motors sparks. And there's a tremendous explosion inside of Lexington that actually wipes out her.
That was caught on film too, I think, wasn't it?
The later ones were, but yeah. But that first major explosion wipes out her main DC party, her damage control party.
Yeah.
So at that point, you know, the fires are starting to spread. And I believe it or not, Lexington is still conducting flight ops after these explosions. And I say explosions plural because there were multiple. And that's what winds up killing her eventually. Captain Ted Sherman, who was the skipper of Lexington, you know, he waited until the absolute last minute to finally give the order to abandon ship. Lexington slows down. She stops. And if you look at footage, like you're talking about, Bill, there, you can see our imagery. You can see Lexington literally is being consumed from the bow to the stern. The fire's coming all the way down. the length and breadth of the ship.
Operable aircraft on her flight deck that
quite a few
that go down with the ship.
Yeah, like 35 of them, I think 35 or 36. And you know, it's one of the more it's a very calm evacuation of the vessel. You know, and again, the guys I talked about before, Ted Wiebe and Walt Nelson, you know, they were on the flight deck, took their shoes off. Everybody lines their shoes up in neat, orderly rows.
Climb down the rope.
Well, they're eating ice cream before they go down. So they go raid the gee-dunk stand and they're eating ice cream on the flight deck before they go over, you know.
Waiting for their turn to climb
down the rope. Yeah, yeah. It was very calm and orderly, and they go down the lines into the water. They're picked up by destroyers and cruisers, and off they go. But Lex is just eating herself alive, and Sherman is the last guy to go over. He's walking off the flight deck to go into the water, and he turns around and he says to his XO, he says, "Wait a minute, I got to go get something." And initially, they thought that Sherman was going to try and go down with the ship. Yeah, he was going to like barricade himself and go down.
Which what's happening in the Imperial Japanese Navy.
Right. But Sherman goes back inside the aircraft carrier and grabs his ceremonial dress cover. His, you know, as I call it, the Captain Kidd cap. You know what I'm talking about. I know you do.
Yeah. Puts it on. Like an Admiral Nelson hat or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. Puts it on and goes over the over the side of the aircraft carrier. And he looks at his XO and he says, "Well, hell, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it in style." I mean, you got to love the guy's attitude, you know? But it's a sad thing to see, because it's the footage that I'm going to show in the video version of this podcast. You'll see it. It's just, you know, the ship is being eaten alive, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's this final tremendous explosion on the stern, which we think are her torpedo warheads cooking off, and it flings airplanes over the side of the flight deck and everything else. I mean, she's gone. There's nothing.
Yeah. So we lose the Lexington, and we've already hinted that Yorktown will be around for Midway.
Right.
And so we lose one carrier and the other one's heavily damaged. And what do the Japanese think happened to us?
Japanese think they sunk everything we had.
Right.
You know, they think correctly that they've sunk Lexington. They actually identified her as Saratoga, but I mean, it is what it is.
Well, they look the same, yeah.
Right, yeah. And they think that they sunk the Yorktown, which, of course, they did not. And they actually also reported having sunk the battleship California. This goes back to Admiral Crace's, you know, unfortunate incidents out there. But which the Japanese, there. Right.
Yeah, California wasn't there.
They actually, you know, they think this is a tremendous victory over the United States Navy.
And to an extent, they only lost Shoho when they had damage to... Which other carrier?
Shokaku is damaged enough, and this is why Coral Sea is so important to the future events of the Pacific War. Yes, we lose Lexington, and yes, we sink the Shoho. However, we damage Shokaku in such a way that she is not able to participate in the Battle of Midway, and she was slated to go.
And what about Zuikaku?
Zuikaku's not touched. She's not physically touched. However, her air group losses are so severe
she have pilots.
Correct. She too cannot participate in the upcoming Battle of Midway. So if Coral Sea doesn't happen, or if it doesn't happen in the way we see it happens, there's six carriers at Midway as opposed to four Japanese.
And who knows what the outcome would have been had there been six Japanese aircraft carriers at Midway instead of four.
I think you could make the argument that it would not have been good.
Yeah, we only had three. One could argue 2.5, because Yorktown is not a full-up round when she participates in Midway. And we'll talk about that later, is the miracle of getting Yorktown underway from Midway. So it's a tactical loss for the United States. We lost one fleet carrier and the other one severely damaged.
Right.
The Japanese lose one light carrier and two carriers are taken out of action for Midway.
Right.
So it turns out to be a draw, or perhaps even a strategic victory, because it leads to a real victory at Midway.
Correct. And, you know, that's exactly right. This is not a tactical victory for the United States, because Nimitz himself said trading Lexington for Shoho is not acceptable.
It's not a good exchange.
Yeah, good rate of exchange. It's not going to happen. That is not how we do things. But the Japanese, because of the fact that Shoho is destroyed, Shokaku and Zuikaku are put out of action. Shokaku turns tail and goes back home. Zuikaku doesn't have the air group really to do anything. The Japanese planned invasion of Port Moresby is stopped.
The planned invasion from the sea.
Right.
Landing invasion.
This particular invasion.
Yeah. And in fact, the Japanese changed their strategy to conduct a over the mountains land invasion of Port Moresby, which effectively neutralizes it because that becomes way harder than they ever imagined it would be.
The Owen Stanley Mountains are not the Smokies.
Yeah. No. No.
They're a little more difficult, and the Australians had a little something to say there. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that this is the first time in the Pacific War, and this is huge, that the Japanese advance is checked.
Is stopped. Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
This is it.
And not just the maritime advance with the fleets, but also the land war with the taking of Port Moresby, both the tactical issue, operational issue with the fleet and the land objective are not achieved.
Right. And this is a slap in the face to the Japanese, and this is a feather in the cap for the United States. And that we were fully aware that the Japanese were trying to invade Port Moresby. We're also fully aware that this particular invasion, this invasion fleet, has been turned around. So while losing the Lexington is something, it's obviously very regrettable, we accomplish our mission, and that we stop the Japanese from doing what they wanted to do. And it's the first time in the Pacific War that we do that. Mm-hmm. And it's huge. You know, we're going to argue, I'm sure, at some point, you know, that Midway is not the turning point of the Pacific War. My opinion is staunch in that it is not. However, the events that happen all the way back from February 42 at the hit and run carrier raids and the Doodler raid and Coral Sea and Midway do start that turn of events. You know, it really does. You know, the meat grinder at Guadalcanal is going to be the ultimate decision maker, but that turn is started here at Coral Sea.
And from the grand strategy standpoint, Nimitz is very, very specific, not precise, but specific in his guidance for Midway.
Yep.
And that is that the strategy of calculated risk will be used in deciding how to execute the campaign at Midway. Right. And he said that because he realized we can't keep up the exchange rate that we saw at the Battle of Coral Sea.
No,
so he changes the guidance, makes it, you know, very specific, but not precise. And I say that because he still gives the operational commander the flexibility to decide exactly how to conduct the campaign. Mm-hmm. But the first thing he's got to keep in mind is, what do you risk versus what do you intend to gain? And that's how he defined calculated risk.
Right. And that's how he governs himself and his commanders, certainly for the next month or so anyway, all the way through June. And, you know, the thing is, to hit on that, what you just said, Bill, is that, you know, there was no parity at this point in terms of U.S. and Japanese carrier forces. Yeah, we sunk one, but we also lost one. And we were behind the eight ball to begin with.
All we had was
Yorktown, Lexington, Enterprise. Hornet is there by now. So you got four carriers. Saratoga is laid up in the yard in Bremerton for having taken a torpedo. And the Japanese got Akagi, Kaga, Soryu, Hiryu, Shokaku, Zuikaku. There's six fleet carriers versus, you know, ours. So there is no parity at this point. And it's something that governs everything that he does for he being Nimitz, for the next at least month and even further.
Right.
So closing this one up, what lessons do we learn here? You know, some of the things you mentioned it briefly before is, you know, damage control operations aboard Yorktown, frankly, save her. You know, she was already severely damaged, but she could have, you know, had a really bad day if her damage control officer hadn't flushed out her fuel lines. This is something that we learn at Coral Sea. They fill the lines with what CO2, isn't it?
Carbon dioxide, right? Yeah.
At Midway. And this becomes SOP for American carrier operations for the rest of the war.
Right.
And Japanese don't do this. And we see the results of that.
Our advantages of intelligence and damage control really, really continue. They were an advantage here, and they continue to be through the next 3 years.
Yeah. And it's the lessons that we learn here, aside from those, you know, is maybe try and coordinate your air attacks.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would say broader than that, one of the lessons we could have learned that we failed to was that the Japanese operate the carriers in concert with each other differently than we do. We still had times when the two carriers strike groups, I'll use modern terminology, were out of line of sight communications and had no idea what the other one was doing. Mm-hmm. So in theory, they're both under the command of Fletcher, but they're separated by, let's say, 60 miles, and they're conducting independent attacks and operations without coordinating because they're under emissions control, MCON, radio silence. Mm-hmm. And so they're not telling each other what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that failure to coordinate, we assumed the Japanese were operating their carriers the same way. In fact, they were operating them in tandem. So they operated their multiple carriers basically as a single organic operational entity. Yep. And so if we had known that, we would have approached Midway a little bit differently. And we would have understood that they might actually be operating four aircraft carriers together in a coordinated fashion, despite the fact that that's not the way we operate it.
Right.
So we could have learned from the way Shokaku and Zuikaku were operating together, and we didn't figure that out yet at Coral Sea.
And, you know, not to look too far into the future, but this is something, piss poor coordination, frankly, on the U.S. side, is something that this is not the only time that it occurs. It occurs at Midway. It occurs all the way in the Guadalcanal, Eastern Solomons and Santa Cruz too. Those are the other two carrier battles in 42. Yeah. It's like, dang.
How many times you have to learn this lesson, right?
Yeah. But you know, you really don't see a heavily coordinated assault from an American aircraft carrier again until 1944. What may have been. I think we should wrap this sucker up, Bill. What do you think?
I agree.
I think we've done well. I hope we've explained the importance of this operation to you guys. And as always, if you have any comments or questions, please send them in. We'll be more than happy to answer them and do our best to do that very thing. Or if you want us to explain something further, Bill and I do plan to do an episode, hopefully, where we can, you know, answer some of those questions as they come in. But with that being said, we do want to thank you for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast, wherever you receive your podcasts, and give us a rating and review. And please do give us a rating and review, because that does help other people find our podcast. I'm seeing some ratings come in, but the reviews help too. Tell us what we're doing right. Tell us what we're doing wrong. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. Make sure and look us up on Facebook, like and subscribe our page there as well. As I said, if you have a question, comment, or suggestion, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, my name is Seth Perrin, and I want to thank you for listening. Bill?
Yeah, this is Bill Todi. Our next three episodes are going to be on the Battle of Midway with our special guest, John Parshall. Tune in. I guarantee you they're going to be great. John is one of the best historians in the world. Absolutely. On the Battle of Midway. So please tune in.
Absolutely.
We'll see you, Seth.
Yep. See you, Bill. Take it easy.
Take care. Bye.
All right.